On this edition, best-selling author Thomas More comes on the program and talks about a guide to creating a personal spirituality in a secular world. I'm Richard Brendan, and the conversation begins now. You know, something essential is missing from modern life. Many who've turned away from religious institutions and others who've lived wholly without religion hunger for more than what contemporary secular life has to offer, but are reluctant to follow organized religion's strict and often inflexible path to spirituality. Well, in a new book, A Religion of One's Own, best-selling author and former monk Thomas More explores the myriad possibilities of creating a personal spiritual style either inside or outside former religion. 2 decades ago, More's Care of the Soul book touched a chord with millions of readers yearning to integrate spirituality into their everyday lives. In A Religion of One's Own, More expands on the topics he first explored shortly after leaving the monastery. He recounts the benefits of contemplative living that he learned during his 12 years as a monk, but also the more original and imaginative spirituality that he later developed and embraced in his secular life. At a time when so many, I think, feel disillusioned with or detached from organized religion, yet long for a way to move beyond an exclusively materialistic rational lifestyle, this book points the way to creating an amplified inner life in a world of greater purpose, meaning, and reflection. The author, Thomas More, is the author, as I stated, of best-selling book Care of the Soul and 15 other books on deepening spirituality and cultivating soul in every aspect of life. He's been a monk, a musician, a university professor, and a psychotherapist, and today he lectures widely on holistic medicine, spirituality, psychotherapy, and the arts. He lectures frequently in Ireland and has a special love of Irish culture, and he has a PhD in religion from Syracuse University and has won several awards for his work. 3 of his books have won the prestigious Books for a Better Life Awards. He writes fiction and music and often works with his wife, artist and yoga instructor Hari Kareen. He writes regular columns for Resurgence, Spirituality and Health, and the Huffington Post. Much of his recent work has focused on the world of medicine, speaking to nurses and doctors about the soul and spirit of medical practice. I have been greatly influenced by his books over the year. It's a joy to have him make a return visit to this program, and he's joining us from Sarasota, Florida. Thomas More, welcome to the program.
Thank you, Richard.
You know, such timing for a much-needed book on a topic people are currently struggling with as they move away from the religion of their roots. I think searching for something that speaks to their soul at a depth level they're yearning for. I love how you show that it's acceptable to incorporate practices from many different spiritual traditions in order to create something that truly touches the individual spirit. In your book, you write, "My intention is to intensify rather than weaken our reliance on the world's religious and spiritual traditions, to do that by letting go the habit of feeling obligated and coerced. We could instead freely and happily turn to the spiritual ways of the past for ideas and inspiration. Our personal spirituality could then mesh with tradition in a creative and joyful way." Now, I got to tell you, Thomas, as the director of a spiritual center here in Indianapolis that tries to honor all paths, I so see the wisdom in this each week. There's no need to discard everything, but instead to polish it with what speaks to each person. It's nice to get this discussion out for those who need it, and great timing on this new book for you.
Well, thank you. I think that I felt it was the right time because I hear from so many people on my travels that they are in great conflict because they just can't stay anymore with the formal institutional religion they grew up in. Mm-hmm. And yet they don't want to just enter into a secular life where there's no spiritual home for them. Mm-hmm. So I think that this gives people a home, which is, as you were just saying, quoting my book, that it's a combination, really, of the great traditions. And I just have the I mean, I just have a great, great respect and appreciation for the religious traditions. But also, a person's own way of life and what you're born with and where you have to go, your destiny. And if you don't combine those things, then religion becomes kind of an off-the-rack thing where you just take what belongs to everybody, and people tend not to be as engaged as they ought to be.
Yes, yes. In the beginning of the book, when laying out the foundation for this new spirituality, you write, the criticism about drawing from several traditions, that it's like eating in a cafeteria, and it has a point, it can be superficial. You suggest, though, a remedy for falling into that trap. Can you talk a bit about how to avoid the superficial spiritual cafeteria, or I say the MCL cafeteria? It's a local cafeteria we have here.
Yeah, right. Yes. Well, you know, what I usually say, first of all, is I like cafeterias, so the metaphor doesn't work too well for me. I love eating at cafeterias. On the other hand, I do understand that some people can do this superficially. My own experience has been that when I turn to a different religious tradition, for example, I guess I've been studying Zen Buddhism for about 30 or more years. And that's the thing. You can do it for a long time. You don't have to just dip into it and look for something else. You can be exploring several different traditions at the same time. Zen has given me, let's say, three or four fundamental attitudes and ideas that carry me a long way, that are kind of the building blocks of my own religion. So they're not superficial. These are very, very important. On the other hand, I've also studied ancient Greek spirituality, and that religion has also given me an immense amount. I mean, I could talk about that for a long, long time. And it has affected me personally, so that my own spiritual life, not just my professional world, my own personal spiritual life has been profoundly affected by that religion, too, and I could go on and on. So yeah. I don't see it as superficial.
Yes. Yes, and because of your love also for Irish culture, I was wondering if you have been also drawn to Celtic spirituality as well.
Oh, yes, absolutely, of course. I spend a lot of time each year in Ireland, and some in Scotland and England as well, but Ireland's really my home. And I'm familiar with so much of the Celtic spiritual life that's there. Mm-hmm. It's not just the obvious places that you go, like Newgrange, Glendalough, these centers of spirituality, but it's in the people, it's in their poetry and song and their way of life, and it's in the land as well. So when I go to Ireland, I just absorb that spirituality. Actually, you know, my ancestry goes back there, and I've lived in Ireland since I was 19, off and on. So it's a very important place to me. And I feel it's in my bones and in my blood. So maybe that's the most important aspect of my own personal spirituality.
Thomas, in this book, you talk about several kinds of mystics, the ordinary mystic, the natural mystic. For those struggling with their spirituality, I think this sheds light on how simple the pursuit can really be. You even talk about how a crisis can push someone into a deeper pursuit, or even simply engaging more with nature. I'm wondering, was there a particular experience you had that pushed you to broaden your spirituality from your practice as a Catholic to honoring all traditions?
It was a gradual process.
Mm-hmm.
I think it began for me, when I was introduced to the work of Père Desjardins, who was a Jesuit priest, who was also a paleontologist, who had developed a theory of evolution that included the spiritual evolution of the human race. And his philosophy was very, very inspiring to me. It led me to see that one's spirituality could be rooted in nature. And once you do that, once you see the natural world as having an important place in your spirituality, at least for me, the experience was that I wanted then to find out what other people in other religious traditions had done, because I didn't see it so obvious in my Catholicism, but when I began to study Taoism, for example, or Native American religion, nature becomes much more prominent and an important resource. So I think it was a gradual thing for me of moving from a narrow view of what religion is to gradually, step by step, a broader view.
Okay. You're listening to The Richard Brendon Show. We're bringing love to life today with best-selling author Thomas Moore. We're talking about his new book, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. We'll have much more of this conversation right after this short break. Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendon. It's such a joy and honor to have Thomas Moore on the program. We're talking about his new book, A Religion of One's Own, a very timely book, I find, since more and more people are craving something unique and tailored to where I think they're at. And Thomas, at the end of part one in your book, you write, "You don't have to believe that anyone is literally behind the song or in the banana or in the earth. You don't have to speak of God. You don't have to talk like a theologian. You only have to use your spiritual imagination to establish a world alive and mysterious and home to a presence impossible to describe, but also impossible to deny." I love this because it seems reachable, but what do you suggest for someone who's an atheist?
Well, I speak favorably of atheism in the book, a little bit anyway, because I think that atheists have a point. They have a very, in fact, I say in the book, if I'm not mistaken, that there's some atheism in my religion as well.
Yeah.
And by that I mean that I think that our narrow and hardened, very limited notions of what God is or the divine is, what the sacred is, they need to be criticized, and that's what atheists are doing. They're saying this is not, doesn't make sense, and it's not adequate. And I think the trouble is that they stop there and make a religion out of that criticism, and that doesn't work for me, so I can't be an atheist. But I think they have an important point to make. So I would say, though, that if an atheist were to read this book, that and I had atheists in mind, if an atheist read the book, they could say, well, maybe I could be an atheist and still have a spiritual life. I could especially find the sacred, and as you quoted there, some indication, some manifestation of the mysterious and the holy in the ordinary world that doesn't contradict your atheism.
Yes. I love something that Father Richard Rohr, another one of my favorite teachers, said once about something to the effect of he believed that nature was the original Bible. And I'm seeing more and more men and women from various faith traditions coming to this central point. It's rather exciting. It's like there's some kind of a renaissance taking place here.
You mean about nature being so important in the spiritual life?
Absolutely.
Yes. Well, you know, it's so important to us now because by not seeing the holiness in nature, we have exploited it far beyond what was reasonable. And so in order to survive, we have to recover that sense of the sacred in nature. Some people are worried about it traditionally because they think we're worshiping nature, but that doesn't make any sense because we're not saying that nature is the God, you know, that we take away any notion of the divine and say it's only nature. Rather, it's seen that nature is a manifestation of the holy and that there's a sacred quality to it. And that when you approach the natural world, whether it's beauty or it's really frightening power, in either case, I think you get a sense of that which is beyond you. And if nothing else, nature serves as a metaphor.
Mm-hmm.
As you look at nature, as you're in nature,
mm-hmm.
it points you further and further in your own life, wherever you are in your life, towards something that is deeper and beyond your reason, beyond what you can understand.
Mm-hmm. In part two of your book, A Religion of One's Own, you begin the discussion of specific aspects of personal spirituality. In the first section, you talk about dreams and their importance. You write, "Dreams get to our very essence. They are mythic, sacred texts that tell the deep story of our destiny and progress. Altogether, they constitute a personal Bible, many stories in many different genres strung together in one book of life. Therefore, a dream practice fits well as part of a larger spiritual way of life, as a piece of your own religion." Thomas, you mentioned that you have been working with dreams in your practice for some time. Can you suggest some concrete ways for listeners to work with their dreams to enhance their spirituality?
Yes, I can't in a short time tell you how to, you know, deal with dreams in general, but
mm-hmm.
I can say this, that in that experience of mine, it's now been 35 years at least of doing therapy with dreams, mostly with dreams. And I wish I could convey this. It's very difficult to do this, but when I work with a person in their dreams, we find that the dream really is a guide to us. They're not easy to understand, but art is not easy either. It's just that we have to get more familiar with the language of imagery.
Mm-hmm.
Once you do that, you begin to see that these dreams capture in a timeless way everything you are. Like, they're not just about today, and yet they are about today. Bits of your past come in. Bits of the world and of life that are somehow outside of you enter into it. It's a very mysterious business about dreams, but they are timely, and they it's amazing to me how they seem to be right there at the they're there for today to show you the direction that you need to go in, if you can only stay close to them. It requires a daily practice, and that's the ritual aspects of dreams,
mm-hmm.
where you listen, you know, write your dreams down and look them over and talk about them with somebody. And I do not recommend just trying to interpret them and finding books that tell you what each image means,
mm-hmm.
but rather to go deeper into yourself as you reflect on the dream.
Mm-hmm. Knowing you've used dreams in your practice for so many years, I really want to ask you this question, because I've had a lot of people ask me this, and that is, what do you do if, you know, we've been told that we dream all the time, but I've had a lot of people say, I don't remember my dreams.
Mm-hmm.
Do you have any suggestions for that?
Yes, I hear that quite often. The best suggestion I have is that you wake up slowly, don't do anything, stay in bed for a while, have a notebook handy, write down whatever comes to you, and if it isn't much, that's okay, because if you begin that practice, I think you'll find that it develops and expands.
Mm-hmm.
And another thing is that once you begin to talk about your dreams and discover that they really do have some value to you, then you'll have more desire to capture your dreams. I think that's also part of it.
Yeah. What are some of the things that seekers can discover through working with their dreams?
Well, they can discover what is going on in them,
mm-hmm.
at a very deep level. If you tell your story, let's say a client comes to me and tells me what's happening.
Mm-hmm.
They have a problem they want to resolve, let's say a marriage problem, something like that. Well, we can talk about that just on the surface and try to figure out how to communicate better and to find out what has happened in your relationship and all that. But when you look at your dreams, and the dream will reflect those conflicts,
mm-hmm.
and images, what you find out is that there are much deeper issues involved in this problem. It's not just a problem to solve on the surface. There's something going on at a much deeper level that embraces your childhood, your interfering in what you're going to do in your life. Some relationships you've had that you've even forgotten about. All of this comes together in the dreams. That's one reason why they're hard to understand, because there's so many layers to them. But what happens, though, is that you're able to deal with these issues because you're looking at them at their roots rather than just at the surfaces.
Okay. My guest today is Thomas More. He's best-selling author, actually best-selling book, Care of the Soul, and 15 other books on deepening spirituality and cultivating soul. We're talking about his newest book, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. This is The Richard Brendon Show. We'll have much more of this conversation right after a word from our sponsor.
Wellness is an active process of becoming more aware and making better choices that move you in the direction of a more successful life. Choices to eat well, move well, and think well enable your body to live well. When your spine is aligned properly, your brain and body are connected. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic is a family wellness center where we focus on your lifestyle and the impact it has on your spine, brain, and your life. Find us on Facebook at Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, or our phone number is 317-863-0365.
This WICR program is underwritten in part by Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. They carry organic produce and bulk body care products such as shampoo, lotion, soaps, and shower gel. Their kitchen serves soup, sandwiches, hot entrees, and carryout food. Plus, they have a juice bar. Georgetown Natural Foods Market, located at 4375 Georgetown Road on Indy's west side. Their website is georgetownmarket.com.
Welcome back to the program. We're bringing love to life today with Thomas More. It's an honor to have Thomas on today's program. Thomas, I have so enjoyed your writings over the years. I really love this book, A Religion of One's Own. And in the book, you go on to talk about self-therapy, and you mention how in self-therapy you may discover how interesting your soul is. Can you talk a bit about what you mean by this?
Well, we tend to think of ourselves as problems to solve. We have so many difficulties getting on in life that I think we begin to see that we are just one big problem or a massive problem. But when you begin to really doing a therapy as I describe it, which is not trying to improve or to figure yourself out, but rather to get to know yourself and care for yourself, to allow yourself to manifest, to become part of life. When you do that, you realize that you are quite an interesting person, that there's so much more going on than you thought of before. And even the dark things, even the negative things, and the mistakes and failures and difficult times all have a place. They make the story that much more interesting. And if you can get to the point where you can accept yourself in spite of your failures, then you begin to love yourself, and that's what I mean when I say you find yourself interesting.
Isn't it fascinating, Thomas, that over the decades with the internet, with DVDs, with webinars, spiritual teachers all over the world talking about loving yourself, it's still probably the number one need that we need to do more consistently?
You know, it requires a shift in the way you picture yourself and your world. And what I find is that with all the teaching that goes on, so much of it stays within the same paradigm, within the same way of looking at life. What's required is a really radical shift. And that's what I try to do. I'm trying to do in all my books is really not so much to say, you know, if you're going to pile on one more idea that on top of what you already know, I'd rather say to read this and be shocked into a different look, a way of looking at life. And it takes that in order to love yourself, because the world we have created with all of its teachings, even the interpretations of spiritual texts with the great teachers around, the majority of it is still within the same paradigm. And that is not going to take us where we need to go.
Yeah, there needs to be that shift in perception.
That's right.
Yeah.
That's right. And it has to be done pretty much then on an individual level. That's that religion of your own idea. You know, you've got to, it has to happen in you.
In part three of the book, you talk about the carnal spirit, spirituality and sensuality, and you say, Eros is not just about the body, but about the soul. Wouldn't you agree that this is contrary to probably what many may think?
Well, I hope that most of what I write is contrary to what many think. We need some fresh ideas.
Yes,
we need
we
a different way of looking at things. So, yes, it is different to some extent, although I take it all from the past. I find most of this in the past. And one of the ideas I take from the past is that eros, our word erotic there, is not only sexual, but it has to do with any kind of connectedness, things coming together. The ancient philosophers said that even the planets being in their orbit is the manifestation of eros, that there's something erotic, even sexual, about planets staying where they, you know, in their ellipses, where they should be. And also the seasons coming back, that they are in a rhythm and they are connected to a kind of way of life themselves that is erotic. So if we have that big sense of eros, then instead of a small sex of our own, a small sense of our own sexuality, then that bigger sense, I think, will allow us to see that our lives are built on love and desire and the search for pleasure and joy.
Yes.
These are themes I want to emphasize in this book strongly, because part of the old-fashioned religion that doesn't work is its glorification of suffering and masochism, how great it is that you suffer. If only you are a person who has a great virtue and can repress yourself, that has been the goal. I think it's time to give that up, because that's not what religion is really about.
Good for you, Thomas More. I so applaud the path you're on, because we so need this fresh way of looking at things, I believe. You also have a section in your book where you talk about how sex isn't always sex. Can you share what you mean by that?
Yes, I noticed this when doing all this dream work. People bring in their sexual dreams. People have a lot of sexual dreams, and they bring them in, and they begin to talk about their sexual problems, their sexual issues. And what I've noticed is that the dreams, to me at least, seem to be more about their vitality, being alive, instead of just having sex, but about being alive. So I noticed that the sexual dreams seem to be more like metaphors for life rather than about sex literally. And then I thought my next step in my thinking was, well, maybe sex itself is more about vitality and being alive. And then I remembered that an awful lot of people, after they've had a great sexual experience, say that the whole world is great. You know, they see that. They put it in terms that are cosmic or big anyway. And that's another indication, a hint, that our sexuality is about our vitality, about taking life on and really living instead of repressing life. That is really, I think, the core of what it means to be a sexual person. And that's why I say that the soul has its sexuality. It's not just the body.
My guest today is Thomas More, best-selling author, psychotherapist, author of over 15 other books. This new one's a great one, A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. It describes so many of us out there. You're listening to The Richard Brendon Show. We'll have much more of this conversation, but another word from our sponsor.
Richard Brendon, bringing love to life, is underwritten in part by Natural Awakenings Magazine. Each month, Natural Awakenings takes a practical look at the latest natural approaches to nutrition, fitness, creative expression, personal growth, and sustainable living. The magazine also covers the products and services that support a healthy lifestyle. Natural Awakenings Magazine is a free publication and can be found at most healthy lifestyle outlets. Their website is awakenindy.com.
Finding your path in life. Soul searching to find your path is the place to start. It requires getting centered and listening to your soul. It speaks in whispers, you know. Listen. Our subconscious mind has a way of directing us if we allow it. Pay attention to your dreams. Keep a dream journal and listen to your feelings. What makes you feel good? What are you drawn to? Feel your feelings. It may take courage to follow your calling, to go beyond the expected or the norm, but it can bring you great happiness, peace, and a sense of purpose. Be brave. You and only you can take charge of your life, and it's never too late to start. Follow your dreams. A healthy body has a clearer connection to the soul. Call today for an appointment to have your connections checked. Stillpoint Family Chiropractic, 317-863-0365.
Welcome back to the program. We're bringing Love to Life today with best-selling author Thomas Moore. We're talking about his new book, A Religion of One's Own. Thomas, before the break, we were talking about sex, sexuality, and when talking about sacred sexuality in your book, you talk about 10 steps to spiritual sex. Can you share some of those with us?
Well, they're very simple things. Yeah. I suggest, for example, that with all the virtues that people want to practice, when it comes to sex, one important virtue is generosity. That's the spirit of being generous. Instead of just thinking about sex as your own thing, your own sexuality, and being absorbed in yourself, you could really think what it means to give yourself to somebody,
yes,
to let yourself be with someone. And that then becomes a great metaphor for the way we are in the world. It seems to me that if we could be generous to somebody else in a sexual relationship, mm-hmm, you have a chance of being really generous when it comes to being with people in other situations.
Very
so
well,
that's
yes,
one thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and what are a few of the others? I love the... Go ahead.
Well, I'm trying to remember now because that's a list that I don't have it in front of me.
You know, the beautiful thing about generosity, though, is because so many times we are selfish. We want our needs met. And even in, quote, enlightened relationships, people can fall into that. But when you have that attitude, again, I think it requires another shift of perception into generosity. It makes all the difference in the world.
Another one, Richard, is pleasure. I want to emphasize that because I think pleasure has got a bad reputation, and largely because religions have so often encouraged people not to pursue pleasure. Today, someone wrote to me and said that they found me using the word enjoy life in my book, and they said they were always taught not to enjoy, that they were supposed to work hard and only help others and not enjoy life at all. Well, I think that's bad psychology. And one of the points in this book is that we need some good psychology to support our spirituality.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't want to get into that masochistic place where we take pleasure in pain, where we deny ourselves the joy of life.
Absolutely.
And the positive pleasures.
In this same section, you talk about the erotic charge in sacred texts, even when there is no obvious sexuality. I found that interesting. Can you share some examples?
Well, I guess I probably was thinking, first of all, there are the obvious ones, these great Sufi poems.
Oh, yeah.
About what it is to be in touch with the divine.
Mm-hmm.
They use sexual metaphors or love metaphors in such a sensual, strong, intense way that you can the sexuality in it is quite apparent. On the other hand, I would think of something like the teachings of Jesus,
mm-hmm,
and the Gospels.
Mm-hmm.
Those Gospels have often been presented as containing lessons that are hard and difficult, but actually when you read the Gospel closely, you find it full of joy, really. It's a very joyful thing. So you find Jesus is a great cook. He's always cooking food and arranging dinners. And so much takes place around a dinner table. And you think, well, what is this? And his first miracle is at a wedding, which has to do with sex, in at least some way, you know, indirectly maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And he makes wine for the wedding. I mean, that's quite joyous and
very
pleasurable.
Joyous. Yes. I swear Jesus was really an Italian. I don't know if that's ever been documented, but I love...
That makes sense to me.
It does. And when you mentioned Rumi, and then there's Hafez and all the great mystics, you're right. When you read their poetry, you never know if they're talking about the divine beloved or another beloved. And I love that. And something else I'm now thinking about is the Song of Songs, or sometimes we call it Song of Solomon in the Old Testament.
Yeah.
Same thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Well, yes. Now that's quite explicit, very very clear. What's that line? I love. I search for my lover. I search for my beloved in my bed,
yes,
and could not find him. that's quite beautiful, you know, and it's quite sexual in its implication.
Very much so. You then go on to talk about spiritual secularity, and you say, in your own religion, you can heal the split between the sacred and secular, your spiritual vision and your daily life. Can you talk about what you mean by that, healing that split?
Well, I think the point is to be able to see that there's nothing at all anywhere in life in the world that is not sacred,
mm-hmm.
if you have the eyes to see it. I get this from Black Elk, who says that we have to see in a sacred manner. And I think what we do is we tend to see in a secular manner and therefore think that the world is a secular thing. That maybe, let's say, business, that going to work, raising children even, taking care of money, these things we tend to secularize, and I think that's why they become so problematical for us. Within a polytheistic system like the ancient Greeks, there was a god or a spirit for everything, and so that everything had its sacred dimension.
Mm.
And that makes a difference. I think we need to recover some of that sense. And what I do for myself, I don't expect anyone else to be like me in this, but I don't like to have any difference at all between the spiritual and the secular.
Mm-hmm.
So I want to be able to see every single thing I'm looking at, everything I'm doing as part of my spiritual life, having its own sacredness, nothing, no distinctions. And what that does, it takes away that gulf or that distance between the sacred and the secular.
You know, I love what creation spirituality is all about, and I suppose Matthew Fox is a big voice for that, but where it teaches that everything is spiritual, and everybody has an artist inside of them.
Yeah.
And I find that beautiful. I love that quote from Black Elk about we have to see in a sacred manner. There seems to be this theme that you're talking about. It all has to do with that shift in perception. And then there's that slogan, I guess, that I've heard many people share. I don't know who originally came up with it, but if you change the way you look at things, the things you look at change. That is so true, isn't it?
It is. This is pretty much why I keep using the word imagination in my books.
Yes.
Of course, I get that from some of my own teachers, James Hillman and others, mm-hmm. really have made a big deal of imagination. And that's what I mean. It's the way we picture the world, the way we see it, the way we imagine, it really makes all the difference. Therefore, what we have to really work at is our imagination,
mm-hmm.
our vision, the way we see, rather than the things taken literally.
Do you think we lose how to tap into our imagination as we grow older, given typical education that is for our children?
Yes, I think we do. And in a sense, what that means is that we become more enculturated. We buy into the culture around us. And we are living right now in a time of facts, of people only trust what can be measured and proven.
Mm-hmm.
And this is really harmful to the imagination.
Mm-hmm.
There are many, many important things, love, beauty, fantasy, dream, that are not part of that world but are the essentials of our life.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think that this is hurting us tremendously, that we only believe in facts. And that's what we're being told in the media all the time. It drives me crazy.
Yeah, I bet it does.
It hurts us. It hurts us as a people. It destroys our imagination.
It's a joy to have best-selling author Thomas More on today's program. His first book, Care of the Soul, rocked my world as it did millions across the world. He's written more than 15 others. I love this new book. It's called A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. This is The Richard Brendon Show. We'll have more of this conversation, but first, here's a short break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the program. I'm Richard Brendan. My guest today is Thomas Moore. We're talking about his book, A Religion of One's Own. And Thomas, in your section where you talk about finding the sacred in the most ordinary, you have a quote that I love. And you say, "The secular only tends to make us sick emotionally and therefore physically. This is true of a community as well as an individual person. Secularism doesn't take the soul or the sacred into consideration, and this fact alone can affect our well-being negatively." So true. Do you agree then that this secular only functioning we have fallen into is a contributing factor, perhaps, to the rise in anxiety and diseases that we're seeing in our culture?
Well, there's no doubt. And what that also implies is that our problems are really not psychological or sociological. Our problems are spiritual.
Yeah.
You know, that's really the thrust of it. We need good theology. We need theologians galore. Whenever I meet a theology student, I bow down before them and, you know, encourage them in any way I can, because we need theologians. Mm-hmm. We need people who can see deeper than the surfaces. And I mean theologians of our time, not of the past, not theologians defending or explaining some particular system, but actually looking at the world and seeing its mystery and seeing its depth and seeing our relationship to it the way we're talking about it here today. Mm-hmm. So what if we had theologians who could help us with the religion of our own rather than just tell us about some other religion?
Right.
That's the kind of thing we need today in order to combat the secularism that's everywhere.
Absolutely. Can you give us some examples? Because I see you as that person who's serving that role now, and it's a role that I think the majority of the population fits into now when you look at the latest polls. Can you give some examples of finding the sacred in the secular?
Well, it could be anywhere. For example, one thing that sometimes comes to my mind, which really may seem far-fetched, is when we're planning a new highway somewhere around a town or going through a town, and they buy up some properties and they put a road through where the road hasn't been before. Well, that is a theological matter, because we're talking about a community that may have been in existence for a long time. And that time alone of a community being together gives it some of its sacredness. I think all of us can appreciate that antiquity and time passing transforms a thing from being purely useful to being special and having a value that you can't measure. And some people, of course, feel it. You tear down an old building and they feel it. They say, "Oh, my God, that's gone." That is a sense that there's something sacred here. And we don't take that word sacred very seriously. We probably think it's just an adjective, common adjective. I take it seriously. I think it really means sacred, and that some of the religion of our community is disappearing. So I would love to see a theologian involved in highway planning. In order to deal with those issues. I'm not saying we shouldn't build highways,
right,
but we have to be able to build them in such a way that we don't destroy the sacred world. If I can give you another example.
Yes.
In Ireland, there's a sacred hill called Tara. I mean, it was the very heart of Ireland in its ancient history, where kings were made, and it was worshipped. There were statues up there, stones up there. And now they want to put a highway through that will interrupt. It will actually cut away some of the land belonging to this hill. Mm. Well, now, some people, a minority of people, have been fighting it. I've signed petitions myself, because I think theologians need to be there to say something. Now, that's an obvious example, because that's a clear religious site. But I think that in a town, you may have a highway or buildings that are equally sacred to the community, and you have to protect those as you build your highway.
Yes, I so agree. I so agree. In part four of the book, you talk about a poetic life, and you start by talking about art as a spiritual path. You write, "In a sacred milieu, art is not an option, but an essential. I love that statement. Can you talk about why this is so important to a religion of one's own?
Well, first of all, look at the history of art in any culture, and you'll find it has always been directly connected to religion, mm-hmm. always. Mm-hmm. You know, the great Renaissance art that's all about religion, it's all about Christianity and the churches, and the great Buddhist art, which is wonderful, has been connected, obviously, to the teachings and to the presence of the Buddha, and you could go on and on all around the world and see this. And in this book, in this book, I'm always referring to the religious traditions to find out how we should think and do things today. So that's an example. We see that the art and the religions have been absolutely linked for centuries and centuries. That's an indication to us we should take that seriously and figure out how to keep that going for ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
At a less historical level, though, we can say that art itself, we just look at art, visual art, music, any kind of art, it is not just there to entertain us. It's obviously not just there for its financial value,
right,
which we tend to talk about a lot today. It's there because the arts keep us in touch with these great mysterious currents that mm-hmm. go through us as mm-hmm. people. They're very much like dreams. The dream was way, way down deep inside of us, unraveling our lives every day. The arts put us in touch with that deep level. They are absolutely important, especially if you consider your spiritual depth, which is a phrase I don't hear much, spiritual depth rather than the spiritual height, I guess you say, is what we usually think of.
Yes, I like that. I like that. You know, it was interesting when I was studying the Great Renaissance, I found that the leaders of that were really the artists of the time. And I've often wondered if it's going to take that, if it's going to take not only professional artists, but all of us who have that artist inside us. I mean, look at you. You not only write these best-selling deep spiritual books, you write fiction, music. Your wife is an artist and yoga instructor. It seems that that is really crucial if we're going to see profound change in today's humanity.
It's crucial. The arts are not an option. We need them. We need them because they keep us in touch with the sacred, really.
Mm-hmm.
That's what they do. If you consider the sacred to be revealed in our depths as well as out there in nature and out in the world.
Yeah.
And so the arts are so important to us, not so much as interpreting them to find out specifically what they mean. That's not important.
Mm-hmm.
We've emphasized that, what the arts mean. That's not necessary. The important thing is that we live with art, and by that coexistence, we are then in touch with the absolute depths of who we are. We will be able to heal ourselves better and get along with each other much better.
You also talk about angels and muses in this book. Can you share your thoughts on these two influences in our spirituality?
The religions have, not just Christianity, but the religions, Judaism and Islam, and
mm-hmm.
many religions show us angels
mm-hmm.
In their stories and in their visual arts. And I've studied these angels over the years. I love to look at them closely and see what they're doing, probably because most of the angels are musicians. That appeals to me,
yeah,
being a musician. But not only that, but they are obviously they are important figures. We have probably defended ourselves against their real meaning by turning them into sweet sentimental things. But in fact, they are powers. They are great powers in life and in the world. I'm not saying they exist out there literally like trees and automobiles, but they exist the way love does and the way knowledge does and the way the spirit of a place does.
Mm-hmm.
They actually exist. But they are depicted in sacred art, and so we can have a relationship to angels, and we would have then their traditional role is to be the intermediary between our human life and divine life.
Yeah.
So we need that.
And what about intuition, Thomas? You dedicate a space to discussion of this topic as well. Can you share your thoughts on intuition and inner guidance?
Well, it seems to me, again, looking at the religions, you find stories that people find themselves and find their way in life through dreams and through signs in the world and through their deep intuition, mm-hmm. and through the visitations of angels too. So what does all that mean? It means that in our secular world, we guide ourselves by what's practical and what is reasonable. So we may decide where to live by figuring out if we can make a good living there or not. But it might be more religious, might be more part of our religion, and therefore deeper and more effective ultimately, mm-hmm. to look for the signs, to use your intuition of where to live and where to go and what to do next. Read the signs rather than do what's reasonable and what makes sense. To live in a dreamier state where you are, you're not just there at the place where you're weighing all the pros and cons, but you're paying attention more to the knowledge of the heart, which yeah. is one way of looking at intuition.
Absolutely. Thomas, I know that a lot of your work has been focused on the world of medicine, speaking to healthcare providers, nurses, docs about soul and spirit of medical practice. I so was moved, greatly moved by your book, Care of the Soul in Medicine. And with a hospice background, I've seen such a need for that. So many of our hospitals and such are just so sterile. Have you seen a change as you have been a messenger out there in healthcare? Are you seeing more people wake up to the creating sacred space in our hospitals and healthcare places?
I'm seeing some people do it. You do see some changes as mm-hmm. you go, as I go from one hospital to another.
Mm-hmm.
I do see that now there may be meditation rooms where before you didn't find those. There's more of a sense of the protection of the individual, so you don't have chaplains proselytizing and kind of being too forceful with their own agendas.
Yes,
there's that going on. The spiritual side is often connected up with alternative medicine, that kind of thing.
Mm-hmm.
So those changes are gradually happening, and certainly the scene has shifted.
Mm-hmm.
But there's nothing, I would say there's but there isn't enough yet that's really significant, really
mm-hmm.
significant. You still go into hospitals. Even the new hospitals are built as factories for the body,
yeah.
and they're not healing places for the persons, for people.
Mm-hmm.
There is still not among the professionals, the doctors, and of course it's always been so for the nurses to some extent, but still it's not, the idea of treating a person rather than a body still is not caught on nearly where mm-hmm. it has to be.
What I love so much about you, Thomas Moore, is your balance of your keen intellect with also a very compassionate heart. I have enjoyed this latest book. I know our listeners will want to follow your work. Can you share your web address with us, please?
Yes. Yes, my website is careofthesoul.net. That's careofthesoul.net. I do a tweet every morning that I hope is very substantial and worth looking at, and it's on my Facebook. The tweet address is Thomas Moore Soul.
Wonderful. The book is A Religion of One's Own, A Guide to Creating a Personal Spirituality in a Secular World. The author, Thomas Moore, thank you for continuing to share your bright light in this world. And thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Well, I always enjoy talking to you, Richard.
It's a blessing. Thank you, sir. I so appreciate the work of Thomas Moore. And once again, his web address is careofthesoul.net. We're bringing love to life here on The Richard Brendon Show. I'll have some closing thoughts, but here's another great song from Jason Mraz.
If this life is one act, why do we lay all these traps? We put them right in our path when we just want to be free. I will not waste my days making up all kinds of ways to worry about all the things that will not happen to me. So I just let go of what I know I don't know, and I know I only do this. not living in the moment, living my life, easy and breezy, with peace in my mind, with peace in my heart, with peace in my soul, wherever I'm going, I'm already home.
Get what you intend to create by being in harmony with the power of God, which is responsible for all creation. Your feelings create a magnetic field that completely surrounds you. Every person is surrounded, I think, by a magnetic field, and so wherever you go, the magnetic field goes with you. It's through the magnetism of your field that surrounds you that you attract or draw to you everything in your life. Every single time you give love through your feelings, words, or actions, you add more love to the field around you. The more love you give, the greater and more powerful is your magnetic field. I think teachers like Thomas More share that in all the various books that they write. I wanted to share a very quick quote from the book that we just interviewed him about. And Thomas writes this: "Bliss is the joy that arrives when you are released from the pressure to be a small self. Bliss descends when you open yourself to life in all its abundance and breathtaking power, and let it so suffuse you that you forget your worries about being somebody and justifying your life. You give in. You let life take over. You become a holy person instead of a secular egotist. And then you discover that your holiness is the base of your own religion." And that's today's program. Our website is richardbrendan.org. Reminder that all shows are podcast on the site. And so for engineer Christopher Shoulders and production coordinator Angel Richardson, I'm Richard Brendan. We're bringing love to life one broadcast at a time.